Okay. Well, listen, I would just like to say thank you so much. I am here in the office of Professor Anthony Kwame Anthony Appiah in Vanderbilt Hall in NYU, and I'm absolutely delighted to be your guest here today, and I'm absolutely delighted to have you here on the UCD podcast. So this is a special edition of the podcast, which we're hoping will be a great resource for the students of Politics and Society course, because as you are aware, you are one of the 16 key thinkers on that course. Not only are you one of the 16 key thinkers on the Politics and Society course, you're also a renowned world thinker on many other key thinker lists, for example the Forbes list. You are share lists with of key thinkers with the Pope is on the same list, which is absolutely incredible. And you have a very, very interesting background yourself, and I'd really like to hear more about how that has shaped you as an academic and influenced your work, I guess, as a philosopher as well. So can I, do you mind if I give a little bit of background about where you grew up and, you know, your family life and everything else? So you were born in London to a Ghanaian father and a British mother. And they had a, I mean, they were one of the, is it 1953 they got married? Mm-hmm. It was the first interracial society wedding, which is absolutely incredible. And then you moved to Ghana after that, where your father was the president of the Ghanaian bar. He was a very influential politician, very active politically. And your mother also was very active in her own way, socially and culturally, and contributing a lot. You then moved back to London and you began a degree in philosophy in Cambridge in 1975. And then went on to do a PhD in Cambridge as well, and received that in 1982. Since then, you have taught at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cornell, and a whole litany of other international, incredibly high-profile universities, and contributed in so many ways to academia. And now, of course, you're back here in NYU, where you live with your husband, who is the editorial director of The New Yorker. Absolutely amazing. And you have been the recipient of many accolades, awards, and honours around the globe. Also, you write on a wide variety of topics: ethics, equality, citizenship, and identities. And also, in your spare time, you're a novelist and a columnist for the New York Times. So, when do you sleep, Professor Appiah? That's my biggest question.
Oh, I get lots of sleep. I mean, I think if you're interested in these topics, it's easy to sit down and think about them. And the world is full of wonderful resources these days. Lots of articles and books and podcasts and television programs and things to watch to stimulate you. So it's
it's a shame. I think, you know, like, young people have access literally in the palm of their hand to all of the information of the world. And some people joke, you know, that, you know, the main things people watch are like videos, YouTube videos of kittens playing the piano and things, you know. And really, it's just about curiosity, isn't it? Academia, I think people have this notion that people who are academics must be like super geniuses and that's it. And I think really the most important thing, just to get you in there, is curiosity.
Yes,
you
know? Curiosity and then sticking to it.
I mean, commitment.
You have to. It's hard work. You've got to read, you know, you've got to read difficult material and make your way through it, and then try and make it. If you're a teacher, you have to try and make it simpler, so that your students who haven't been studying the subject as long as you have can get access to it, and then eventually they'll be able to read the complicated things themselves. But so reading philosophy can take time. If you are doing a literature course, you might ask your students in the university to read a novel in a week. You would never ask people to read the whole of a philosophical work, a book, in a week, because it's just too much.
Because it's also the thinking that goes along with the reading.
Yes, you have to think, you have to stop, have to go back, you have to think, well, do I get that? Do I agree with it? Mm-hmm. If I don't agree with it, why not? And so on. And whereas in a work of fiction, you're being carried along by the imaginative life of the writer, and so you...
So philosophy requires something else of the student.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a very active form of reading, I think. And especially if you're used to this modern world in which so much stuff is just, as it were, thrown at you, and you can, in a way, just sit there and be a passive recipient. It's not like that.
But the really cool thing then about that particular area is that every single individual has something new and unique to bring to the table. So obviously you have a very unique kind of story behind who you are as a person, and I obviously am a very different person then as well, and I have my own experiences and things to contribute. So when I read a piece of philosophy, I can bounce that off my own experience and say, well, actually, do I agree with that? Has that been my experience? Can I confirm that that's true? And, or do I have a completely different angle? Have I found something new? Right. And that's kind of what academia is about, isn't it? Yes. You know, finding new things that you can say, actually, no, that's wrong. Or actually, I've observed something totally new and unique that nobody else has identified yet. Right. And that's the cool thing about philosophy.
You know, one of the main things that philosophers in the European tradition have been doing all along, and this is true about the Confucians and in the Sanskritic traditions of India as well, is they've been, among other things, helping people think about how to live their lives. I mean, that's the central question of ethics, is what's a good life? How should I live? And the answers to that question, I think, are, in the end, quite individual. Everybody's going to live a different life. We are born in different places. We are born with different talents. We develop different talents. We get different interests. Some of us want to be philosophers, some don't. Some want to be novelists, some don't. Some want to be musicians, some don't. Mm-hmm. And all of those choices you make and all of the things about you that are distinctive in your place in time and space affect what the answer is to the question, what is a good life for me? And so the philosophers can give you tools for thinking about that question, but in the end, it's your question and your answer that matters. And one central modern idea, I think, in European philosophy, has been that part of what it is to have a good life is to have a life that you have thought through for yourself. That there's your
own
life.
Do you think people do that?
Well, I think no, not everybody. not everybody has the best life they could for them. But
how many people do you think are actually consciously aware that they do have a choice in terms of you know, how they build their own lives around them? Or do people generally just accept their lot in life and kind of go along with the flow of their own culture and what's expected of them within that culture?
Well, I think that it probably used to be the case in more places and in the past that the range of options was very much narrower for most people. If you were born as a peasant on a medieval estate, the lord of the manor told you what to do. You weren't being given lots of choices about what you were going to do. Most places in the world until recently, you didn't choose your own spouse. That was decided by your family and so on. So the range of choices has widened up. We think it's wrong to compel someone to marry someone now. We means almost everybody in the world agrees with that. Even in places where they have arranged marriages still, they do ask you whether you're going to accept your husband or wife. So,
and even if we look at the moment at what's happening for women, you know, there is really a big revolution in terms of women starting to rise up and talk a lot. And I think that's it. It's kind of like a revolution starts and how society changes. I mean, you gave a quote, a Martin Luther King quote, about how the arc of the trajectory,
the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Progress, was it? Yeah, no. Towards justice. Yeah. So, do you think then that we are gradually evolving to become a better, more equal society in general, or is that a battle, like a back and forth? Like, there's always going to be people who it's not in their interest to have everybody as an equal. You know, Do you think that really, as a global society, we are always shifting towards trying to battle towards equality, and eventually we'll get there, or that it's not actually?
Well, I think you have to recognize and accept that there's been a huge progress towards equality, even just over my lifetime since 1950s, say, the last half century or so, and equality has many dimensions. But one thing that's happened, for example, in the last couple of decades is that hundreds of millions of people who lived in poverty in the world don't live in poverty anymore. So one thing we've done as a species over the last 10, 20 years is radically reduce the amount of abject poverty in the world, radically reduce the number of people who are living close to subsistence. Long way to go. There are hundreds of millions of people left. And the African continent is somewhat behind the Asia and Europe and the Americas. But I think that's something to be celebrated, even as we work to move forward. But I don't think, you know, in the 19th century there were philosophers who thought, and earlier, there were philosophers who thought that sort of progress was sort of built into the nature of the universe, and some Christian providential views suggest that, as it were, providence is moving us, God's providence is moving us forward. I myself think, and I don't want to take sides in theological debates, but even if you even if you're a theist, I think you should think of human beings as having the responsibility of making sure we move in the right direction, and we won't move in the right direction if we don't all work towards it. There's nothing promised, there's nothing guaranteed about progress, so we need to work towards it.
And that's a really interesting thing about philosophy, because I think maybe some people, or particularly people who are thinking about a career, might think, God, philosophy is something that it's a wishy-washy kind of thing. I don't even know what that means, you know. But actually, philosophy is the foundation of a lot of activity, really. You know, like a lot of social activists, politicians, people who are at the forefront of creating change come from a philosophical background. Yes. So really, in order to be a person who's able to actually activate change in the world, having that basis of thought is really important. Yes. And I think that's nice to put that into context, that people understand what the importance of what you do is, you know.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, philosophy covers a very wide field, and some of it is less connected with social life. Not all philosophy is ethics and political philosophy, but I think as a whole, if you take, as it were, philosophy altogether, even the things that people outside philosophy might find it very hard to see the point of, like studying questions about the nature of logical necessity, which is something that philosophers think about, even that work, which isn't directly connected with moving the world ahead, is nevertheless part of the background that people who are thinking about moving the world ahead draw on when they're trying to move ahead. Now, precisely because this kind of thinking is very important to moving the world ahead, it isn't necessarily going to be the case that the people who do the best thinking are going to be the best activists.
No.
But there's a sort of division of labor, and what I try to do in my sort of public-facing work is to try and give people tools to think about what it is to lead a good human life. And some of those people are going to be using these ideas to pursue projects of improvement in the world. Others aren't. Others are going to go on their narrow paths by themselves. But I think providing those tools is the thing that philosophy and philosophers should think of themselves as doing. We're giving people the materials for reflection on how to live. And I think people who've thought about these things can do a better job of moving things forward. But you asked whether the progress was guaranteed. I definitely think that it isn't. I think we make, as it were, two steps forward, one steps back sometimes. At the current moment, I think in much of the world, there's a turn away from openness to other people and to respect for people of different identities, which was something that was making progress over the last half century. People were becoming more open, more tolerance.
So maybe we're at the point where we're starting to take a little step back.
Yes.
And that's when it's kind of a push then to use all our, yes, our philosophy, and that's when it comes in handy. So.
Yes. No, I think understanding what the mistakes are that lead people to close off in those ways, yeah, and the mistakes are, some of them are sort of philosophical or ethical mistakes, mm-hmm, some of them are economic and, mm-hmm, and political social and, yeah, political mm-hmm mistakes. But I think philosophers should draw on the best thinking in the social sciences as well when necessary, mm-hmm, in order to answer the question, mm-hmm, you know, how do we move forward?
Mm-hmm. So I just want to let the people who are listening to the podcast know that there's few resources that they can access to, you know, engage with your work a little bit more. So you have a TED Talk on whether religion is good or bad,
yes,
which was absolutely fantastic, about 14 minutes long, really a great piece to watch. And also you were invited to be the Wreath Lecturer in 2016, was mm-hmm it? So the annual Wreath Lecture is BBC4, it's available on podcast, and congratulations on that. It was a series of four fantastic lectures, which you gave on colour, creed, country and culture. And I thought it'd be interesting to discuss those then for the remainder of the podcast to kind of focus, because we've got a short period of time really here. So the title of that series was Mistaken Identities. And that is one of the areas that you focus on a lot in your work, is the idea of identity. And my question to you is, how do we form our identity? Is it that we receive our identity as a birthright, or do we create it? And what is the balance of that?
Well, I think that the challenge is to combine those two things. On the one hand, you have to accept that you are born into a particular place, into a particular family, into a particular country, into a particular body, and into a particular history.
But do we? I mean, Caitlyn Jenner is a great example of somebody who was born into a specific body and then chose to reject that. And
but her identity depends upon recognizing that for her, it was the wrong body. And in order to recognize that, she had to recognize what body she was in. So you have to, certain things are given, and then you have to work to decide what you're going to do with those materials. Now, some of the materials are given essentially, as I said, by our bodies, by our genetics, by the combination of genetics and environmental influences. But many of them are socially provided. And even the ones that are provided by the body, like our sex, are the meaning of them is given by society. There's no natural meaning to the difference between, there's no given meaning to the difference between males and females. Society decides. Society puts its stamp on those things and gives it, which is why we distinguish between sex, which is the biological thing, and gender, which is the social thing. And the thing that matters, obviously, for our lives is gender. What matters is gender. This is, and Caitlyn Jenner has chosen to reject an assignment to one gender and embrace and accept an assignment to another, and that's her choice. But in order to do that, she and other trans people have had to work to change the rest of us.
Yes,
they
I
can't
know.
Do it
and
on their own.
And that's a great example of somebody who is at the forefront of a social change, and how that kind of the ripples of that gradually spread out to, you know, create a new meaning for that identity and what that
so,
is.
So people like Caitlyn Jenner and other earlier people, Jan Morris, a long time ago, who and these are they're both very interesting, of course, because they both experimented when young with actually extreme forms of masculinity. I mean, Caitlyn Jenner was an Olympian, and Jan Morris started out as a war correspondent and you know followed people up Everest and so on, very very kind of macho. So they had to take their sense of who they were and work on it, and it was easier for Caitlyn Jenner than it was for Jan Morris, because it was later in time. And a whole body of people, trans people, but also cis people, have been working together to try and reshape gender so that it's more comfortable for more people.
Yes.
And in the 60s and 70s, a great deal of work was done by straight people and by gay people to reshape sexuality so that it could be more comfortable for more people, that we could. And now, in many places in the world, even the somewhat backward country that I live in, the United States, we have gay marriage, which 30 years ago would have seemed ridiculous.
Well, you know, Ireland obviously was one of the first countries in the world to bring gay marriage in by popular vote, and we're very proud of that.
You should be.
You know, and you are a professor of law and philosophy here at NYU. A question I have is about the role of law in terms of meaning, because law is kind of the ultimate policy of every country, you know. What is enshrined in the Constitution really is kind of like a blueprint for a lot of how we see things, you know. And the Irish Constitution is very interesting because the role of women is defined as a very specific thing, and the role of the family is defined as a very specific thing. It was drawn up, there was a lot of Catholic influence in terms of drawing up. So it's a very Catholic country in terms of its legal underpinnings, you know. And a lot of that is shifting at the moment. But you know, I'm not a gay person, so I would never have understood what it would have been like to have been denied the right to marriage. Mm-hmm. But there's been so many accounts of people speaking about their experience since the law has been changed, about how accepted they feel and how, you know, just the sense of, just a different sense of who they are as an individual, because they have been validated in some way by the rest of the people that they live around, and because that's in law, it means a whole different thing. Like, I wouldn't have considered that really before, because it didn't affect me directly. Now, of course, I have many friends who that would have affected, but you know, I think law is really something important. Obviously, you know, people like Caitlyn Jenner have a really high profile in the media and have the ability to kind of change things, but how important do you think the law is in terms of...
Well, I think it can be very important, and so pushing on the legal front for progress on trans rights and LGBTQ rights and women's rights and the rights of racial minorities and religious minorities, I mean, all of these things, it's very important to get the law right. But as the Irish case, I think, beautifully demonstrates, what really matters is, as it were, is the public culture. And so there's an interesting dialectic. So the Ireland did this very different thing from many other places. You said, we'll leave it to the people, we'll trust the people. And the people, in my view, did the right thing. So in a way, in Ireland, the thing that gay and lesbian people in Ireland must feel is not just that the law is on their side now, but that it's on their side because the society declared itself on their side. So, yes, but law is nevertheless very important. Law expresses, as it doesn't just command things and forbid things and allow things. It also expresses things. Laws express ideas about gender equality. They express ideas about the equality. But if you have a law that says, as it did in England well into the 19th century, that when a woman marries, her property is under the control of her husband, that she doesn't have any independent property rights anymore, Of course, it denies women all sorts of powers, but in particular, it says to them, "You're a kind of second-rate kind of person. You don't know how to manage your own affairs." Yeah. So law expresses things, and it's very important that it expresses the right things. But on the other hand, I think it's important to see that the law can express the right things, and social reality can be behind the law. Racial equality in the United States was enshrined in amendments to the U.S. Constitution at the end of the Civil War in the 19th century. But the reality of racial equality in the United States was achieved much, much later. And it's arguable that it hasn't really been achieved yet. But there's been a huge amount of progress there. And a lot of that progress came through struggles to change the law. But in those struggles to change the law, society was changed independently of the law. It wasn't just the law that was changed.
So the law was already in place, and it actually society needed to row in behind.
Yes. One of the things that I've been interested in over the recent years is the role of ideas about honour in human life. And there's a very good example in the history of honour about the complexity of the relationship between law and social life. In the history of duelling, which is a big practice in Ireland through the middle of the 19th century, but a very big practice in the 18th century in Ireland and in other parts of the British Isles. And duelling was illegal in England and in the British Isles from the time of Elizabeth I. It was already illegal long, long time ago. But it went on. It went on in part because the very fact that it was illegal made it attractive for upper-class people to break the law in this way in order to claim the privilege of breaking the law, right? Okay. So there, the law was against it. Actually, religion was against it. The popes condemned dueling in the 9th century. Long before it really took off.
So for people who are listening in, dueling is to the death.
Dueling is to the death. Two men with swords or guns, or sometimes other weapons, battling. Sometimes there are rules that say you have to stop when you reach a certain when somebody's, as it were, evidently lost. But very often,
so it's all about honor.
It's dueling for honor. And the point is that, in relation to the question about the law, is that in that particular case, the law really only became effective couple of centuries after it was put in place, because you need the social change as well as the legal change. So there's a complex dialectic between changing the law to get it right and changing society. But I think it's very important to see that legislative change can actually lead social change. So I just noticed, I think it was in the paper today or yesterday here in New York, that two-thirds of Americans now favor gay marriage. Now, that's way more than favored it when it was still not constitutionally recognized.
So the fact that the law is in place has now normalized the larger majority of the population's thoughts.
Yes.
Right, okay.
And this happened, I was... I spent some of my time in the mid-60s in England, and in the mid-60s there was a parliament that decriminalised abortion, decriminalised homosexual sex, and abolished capital punishment, one parliament. And actually all the bills to do that were put through by one man who was a Welsh Labour MP called Leo Absey. He was one of my heroes. But in all of those cases, before the law was changed, the majority of the population was against the change. And a year later, a majority of them had changed their mind. A majority of them thought, okay, we shouldn't have capital punishment, abortion should be legal, and gay sex shouldn't be criminalised.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because today in Ireland we're having a referendum on abortion, repealing the Eighth Amendment, which at the moment makes it illegal for women to have an abortion in Ireland. So it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of that is. And again, a lot of talk, a lot of discussion about that for the last while. So
I think this, again, Ireland is interesting and important here, because you have chosen to do these things through a process of citizen engagement through referenda. And that means, as you say, that there is this public discussion that on the blogs and on the television and on the radio and in the newspapers, people are exchanging, and probably in pubs and bars and families around dinner tables, are having conversations about these things. And that's one thing that I think is really crucial to the development of the political development of societies, is to have a sense that we are all talking about this together. We're one people, one nation, and we are running the republic together, all of us. And so we need to share our ideas about it. We need to have respectful conversations with one another. We need to accept that at the end of the day, these things will be decided by a popular majority, and that that'll mean that some people don't get what they think is the right answer, but that they are still part of the people, they're still part of the republic, they still are your fellow citizens, and you have to be respectful of their dissent.
Yes, yes. So just to talk a little bit about your TED talk, which was about religion and whether or not it exists, and to link in with your Wreath lecture, which was about creed. Ireland is an interesting place in lots of ways, you know, no place more so than our approach to religion, I suppose. You know, it's a very interesting country in terms of how much religion, and particularly the Catholic religion, is tied up into, as I've already mentioned, our law, our education system. I think 96% of primary schools are owned by the Catholic Church, the buildings as such. And, you know, so we have this huge Catholic influence. And, of course, we have a history then in terms of in the north of Ireland, there being a conflict and a divided along the lines of religion in terms of Catholics and Protestants. I'm delighted to say that that's no longer the case in Northern Ireland, and that, you know, we have made a lot of developments in that trajectory of that arc that Martin Luther King talked about. But I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about this idea of religion being a part of your identity, and in particularly in the Irish context, how that...
Well, I think it's clear that historically, obviously, it was never just about religion.
Of course, it's almost what I feel like it's not about religion actually at all.
Right.
You know,
well, I think in a deep sense, it's not about religion, but religious identities were very much involved, and that's of course for obvious reasons, because there was a Protestant ascendancy. There was a Protestant ruling class of mostly of English origin, overlaying a population that have been Catholic for, you know, well over 1,000 years.
And so it's about the actual, like, I mean, like, I'm a Catholic. Yes. I was born and raised a Catholic. And there's, I couldn't tell you, there's a lot of things I couldn't tell you about the Catholic religion.
Yes.
You know, that
yes.
possibly if I was a good Catholic, I should. And there have been times in my life where I've wavered in and out of this sense of whether I belong as a member of the Catholic community or not, where I have certainly disagreed with many things, particularly scandals within the Catholic Church relating to abuse, the Magdalene laundries, I don't know if you know what
they were.
You know, and certainly the way that the role of women within the Catholic Church that have brought me to question my membership of that organisation and whether or not I am. And then there's been other times in my life where I've experienced a hardship and I have kind of been brought back into that comfort of that community and belonging there and got a sense of something from that, you know. And yeah, it's that sense of belonging and what religion actually means can be confusing at times.
Well, I think there are many dimensions to the process of deciding to take a religious identity seriously. There are ways of being, as it were, culturally Catholic, which are perfectly consistent with having, for example, no religious beliefs, no theological beliefs at all. You can be culturally Catholic and be an atheist.
That's it. Do you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of a comedian called Dara O'Brien.
No.
He's an Irish comedian. He's absolutely fantastic. But he talks about how he's a Catholic, you know, like he just can't help it. He's a Catholic, you know. And he says, you know, like it's just one of those sticky kind of religions. You know, you can't. He said, I could join the Taliban and I'd still just be a bad Catholic.
You know? Right. Good.
And I think maybe that's how a lot of people feel about
their religions
in general.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I think there's a wonderful philosopher who teaches in New York City at the other end of the island from me at Columbia University called Akhil Bilgrami, who wrote a wonderful paper called What is a Muslim Once, and because he's from a Muslim family in India. And he says, you know, I don't believe in God, but I'm a Muslim.
Nice.
And he grew up in a Muslim family. He's part of a Muslim community. He's also an Indian and, you know, passionate about that too. He's just written a wonderful book about Gandhi, who was not a Muslim. So I think religious identities are like that. They're very complicated. They have, historically at least, what you might call creedal dimensions, dimensions that have to do with being supposed to, you're supposed to believe certain things in many religions. Sometimes it's very simple. You can become a Muslim by believing two things, that there's one God and that Muhammad is his prophet. You just have to raise your finger to heaven and say that, and you're a Muslim. The Christian creeds have always been rather complicated, starting already in the 2nd and 3rd century, so the Nicene Creed and the Athanasian Creed and all the early creeds of the Church, which we still hear in both Catholic and Protestant churches, are full of stuff that, if you think about it, it's rather hard to know what you're supposed to be thinking. You're supposed to believe, you know, that Christ is of one substance with the Father. Well, substance is a medieval philosophical idea that goes back to Aristotle. Most people have no idea what substance is. So how could they believe that God is of one substance with the Father if they don't even know what substance is?
That's it.
So I think the idea that you could define Catholic adherence by saying, well, a Catholic is anyone who believes the creeds and of the Church and then you know has learned some Church doctrine, I think that's a mistake, because many people are deeply committed to, for example, the practices of the Church. Many people are committed to going to services regularly, to perhaps praying at home, perhaps every night. These are religious practices, but they couldn't answer you the questions about the creed. So it's not that they believe or disbelieve. They just don't know what the creed is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they've been through preparation for First Communion and so on, where they will have been trained, I think most of us would have to admit, and I went to Anglican versions of that, that I ended up not being at all clear about, even though I'm a relatively smart person.
Because you talked in your Wreath lecture about orthodoxy
yes.
and orthopraxy,
yes.
you know, and I guess that's where the difference is, kind of understanding the doctrine
yes.
and understanding how you're supposed to behave, your activity yes. as a person, yes. you know. And I guess probably a lot of Irish people, you know, who are in the same position as me, say friends of mine who I would have yes. discussed this with, you know, that maybe I don't fully understand, you know, but I do try to attempt yes. to be a good person yes. in terms of what my religion has taught me, a good person should, the way a good person yes. should behave, you know. So is that enough? Is yes. that enough?
Well, I think orthopraxy... again, religions are very diverse, mm-hmm. but there are things that the sort of central cases of most of the big religions of the world require of adherence. There are things they're supposed mm-hmm. to do, so that's what orthopraxy mm-hmm. is about. It's the proper doing,
yes.
not proper thinking, but proper doing. But, of course, among the range of things that can be proper doing is anything that can be counted as moral behaviour. So at the heart of all the Christian traditions are 10 commandments, which are relevant to everyday life. Not stealing is relevant to everyday life. Not murdering is relevant to everyday life. Honoring your father and your mother is relevant to everyday life. And you could do the first and second commandments are about God, so you can't do those if you don't believe in God. But the rest of them,
yes,
you could certainly adhere to. And of course, Christians don't just think. They think the Ten Commandments are hugely important, but they don't think the Ten Commandments cover every aspect of morality. There are lots of mm-hmm. things about how we should behave that aren't directly covered by the... Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, Christ himself said that the greatest commandments were to love God and love your neighbour. And what flows from loving your neighbour is a very complicated thing, as the parable of the Good Samaritan mm-hmm. reveals. So I think there's belief, which I think is, frankly, tends to be overrated by people as a measure of what makes somebody religious. There's the sense of community, identity, and so on that comes. And then there's the things you do because you're a Catholic, a Protestant, a Muslim, a Jew. And those things, and all of them, who's in, who's out, what you have to believe, what you have to do, of course, all of them can be contested. They can be contested because Protestants and Catholics are, after all, fighting about what it means to be the same thing, Christian.
Yes.
They're not fighting about, they're fighting about mm-hmm. the same religion. But, of course, within the Catholic Church, as everybody knows, there are profound disagreements. And now, the Catholic Church, because it's got a hierarchy, has a mechanism for resolving doctrinal questions. It has to go up mm-hmm. and then finally... The church, the authorities of the church have a power, mm-hmm. according to church doctrine, to declare what's right in belief and in behavior. But even when they've done that, even when the church has exercised what it calls its magisterium, its right to teach, even when it's done that, of course there are going to be Catholics who are skeptical, mm-hmm. and are going to say, well. You know, I know that they've issued a statement about this, but I continue to believe that, for example, that women, that there's really nothing, no good reason why there are no women priests. Women have served the church from the beginning.
I don't know if you have ever heard of Mary McAleese. She's former president of Ireland,
yes.
and she recently spoke about that misogyny, she called it, you know, within the Catholic Church, of the lack of the role of women, I think, in
yes.
general, but
yes.
also women being priests. And, you know, certainly I think it's something that the Catholic Church may be thinking about, you know, in
yes.
terms of their future and how they're going to continue on, really, their organisation and how the role that women play
yes.
there. It's an interesting time, I think.
Well, I think it's very difficult for an organisation, all of whose authority figures are men, to have a sensible conversation right. about this. You can't have a sensible conversation about gender equality if you're mostly guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have a sensible conversation
about... Is that privilege? Is that the privileged group... not understanding, rather than have this sense that they just don't want to. Is it? I think with privilege, there's a genuine lack of understanding
yes.
because I think as a privileged person, and I'm sure there's been areas of life where I have been privileged, and I think there is a certain difference of understanding that you
yes.
just you can't comprehend what it's like not to have that privilege.
Right. So I think not seeing that it makes a difference to the voice of authority of women. That there are no women who have the priestly role, that's only something you could do if you hadn't ever been a serious Catholic woman.
Yes.
I don't mean that, of course, there are lots of Catholic men who do grasp this. I'm not saying that it's impossible for a man, just as there are plenty of white people in the United States who have a deep understanding of the horrible character of racial oppression.
Yes.
But I don't think a society can really get to grips with these things unless it listens to everybody, unless it listens to the women about gender equality and to the blacks and the browns about racial equality and to the gay people about
A place sexuality. At the table.
And I think, certainly in my experience, I mean, I feel enormously lucky because I grew up in a family. My parents belonged to two different Protestant denominations, but I grew up in a family where we had Muslim cousins, and we went to Ramadan is a time of fasting for Muslims, but it's also a time of feasting because if you fasted all day, you need to eat when the sun goes down, and so you can, and especially at the end of Ramadan.
So you had the best of all of these religions.
We had the best of all these religions, and our Muslim cousins came to us for Christmas.
Very good.
And I have Jewish cousins, and I have a Jewish husband. So I think... you know, and so I've been to, I don't know, probably 30 Passover Seders in my life now. So I've been to as many Passover Seders as I've been to family Christmases.
So that's interesting. Then do you start to feel like you belong within that faith?
I think I sort of feel that it's now...
Because you're doing the orthopraxy
yes,
in one sense.
It is now part of the... I mean, the Seder... The Passover service is very, very Jewish in the sense that it's about family. You do it at home. The head of the household, man or woman, leads the service. There's no priests, and also it's very Jewish because it's about liberation. It's about recognizing that because Jews were enslaved in Egypt. They have a special relationship to the oppressed, and reminding Jews of their responsibility to the oppressed. So it's a powerfully moving service, and its moral dimensions are things that any decent person could go along with. You don't have to be Jewish, and you don't have to believe in Yahweh. You don't have to believe in the Jewish God. But so I feel that it's now part of my praxy, as it were, part of what I do to remind myself of certain important moral ideas with my family. My husband's family, sort of every year, and I think I'm not a Jew. I think it would be weird to claim to be Jewish because I haven't done lots of things that are sort of required to make that.
But you have
crossover.
Gained a lot from.
But
the
I've
Jewish
gained a lot from that. Just as I've gained a lot from, I've spent the last few years teaching a course in which we spend a fair amount of time looking at Muslim moral thinking, and the Muslim philosophers. I mean, a lot of people in, I think, in the North Atlantic world don't realize that the philosophical traditions of Islam have as much claim to be the heirs to Aristotle as anybody in Europe, because they were the people who studied Aristotle most intensely in the early Middle Ages. And if, in fact, they hadn't held on to the traditions of interpretation of Aristotle, we wouldn't know Aristotle, because Aristotle was ignored during the so-called Dark Ages in Europe. So, except in Ireland. where part of civilization was kept alive during those Dark Ages, so that's an important part of the story too. But Muslims, therefore, have this deeply philosophical part of their tradition. Now, they also, just as Catholicism has St. Thomas Aquinas, which is also a deeply philosophical tradition. Now, lots of things about Catholicism have nothing to do with St. Thomas Aquinas. And lots of things about Islam have nothing to do with philosophy and Aristotle. But still, I've learned a lot from reading this tradition. And one of the reasons it's taught me things is because, not really because of the Aristotelian part, actually, though that's very important, but because Muslim tradition, because it's draws on the Quran, of course, has this reference back to a passage in the Quran which says that it's the duty of every devout Muslim, every proper Muslim, to command right and forbid wrong. So every Muslim is given the duty of holding their own community to high moral standards. That's not the case in every ethical tradition. It's not the case in some traditions. You're just supposed to cultivate your own goodness, as it were, and not worry too much about the mm-hmm. goodness of the community. Now, that's not, of course, Christianity has a long tradition of caring about the community as well. But I think that that particular way of thinking about it, which comes out of Islam, has been very helpful to me in thinking about many questions in political morality. And in the same course, we spend another third of the time thinking about Confucian traditions, and there I think their focus, which goes back literally to Confucius, or to the writings associated with Confucius, their focus on the family as the center of moral life, on the fact that relationships generate responsibilities and duties, is again a very powerful moral picture. I'm not saying that nobody outside that tradition has ever said anything like that. You can recognize things like that in the European and the Muslim traditions, but it's beautifully articulated in the Confucian tradition. So I think we have a lot to learn from looking at the world through the lenses provided by these different rich traditions of thought.
And I suppose the more we expose ourselves to different cultures, different religions, people from all different kind of backgrounds, do we get a stronger sense of our own identity by doing that?
Yes. So that's one of the things that is one of the great misunderstandings of cosmopolitanism, which is the idea that we're all citizens of the world. One of the great misunderstandings of that is to suppose that if you're a citizen of the world, you can't be a citizen of anywhere else. Actually, Mrs. May said this, unfortunately, about the time I gave my Wreath lectures. She said, if you're a citizen of the world, you aren't really a citizen of anywhere. That's nonsense, begging her pardon. The cosmopolitan tradition, which again is a very ancient tradition and goes back in the West at least to the 4th century before the Common Era, has always stressed, in one strand of it, the connection between the importance of local identities and the recognition of our global obligations. And indeed, part of what's cosmopolitan about cosmopolitanism in its openness to other cultures and identities is its recognition that they are different from us and that that's why they're interesting and also challenging, because they will be different in us in ways that mean that they may even challenge our moral ideas and ideas about how to live. But precisely because we think of other people's identities as enriching, our own identities are enriching too. I mean, we're also people with a tradition and a culture. And so far from encouraging people to think that their own identities don't matter, I think cosmopolitanism says you're curating... You, the Irish, or the Irish Catholics, or the Dubliners, or the Cork people, you are curating...
What it means to be...
What it means to be human, because what it means to be human is to be human in a particular way. There's no... You can't be a human being without being a particular human being, with a particular identity.
And it's funny, because New York is like a great hub for the Irish diaspora, you know? So there are pockets of New York where there are huge Irish communities based, and I sometimes think people become more Irish when they are somewhere like this. You know, like my sister used to live in Sydney, in a place called Bondi Beach, and there was a huge Irish community there. And Christmas Day, we were all there. And everybody's wearing their GAA jersey, their Gaelic Games jersey. Yes. You know, like there's this sense of people becoming almost more Irish as a result of travelling away from Ireland.
Yes.
You know.
So I think one thing people do when they're away from home is they kind of perform their identity.
Yes.
They perform. It happens with everybody. It happens with Ghanaians, it happens with Americans, it happens with English people. You kind of put on, you're sort of, it's on display. And also I think it's because when you are away from home, people who are from home are a reminder of home to you, and so you want to gather some of your time with them.
And to kind of celebrate, I suppose, your shared culture then.
Yes.
And the best bits of that.
Yes. I think the best bits are, you know, what one should hang on to. Every tradition, every philosophical tradition, every religious tradition has elements of to be regretted in its history, right? The history of the treatment of women and, for that matter, lesbian and gay people in the Christian Church has been sometimes, not always, pretty horrible. And that's true in many places in the world. Same is true for Islam. and for that matter for the Confucian traditions. So everybody has things to want progress. To get beyond mm-hmm. and to distance yourself from, to acknowledge, accept, mm-hmm. understand, and then reject.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't make progress if you turn your back on all of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can only make progress by working out of where you are, improving your understanding of gender, improving your understanding of race, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can wipe the slate clean and start all over again.
Yes.
When you try to wipe the slate clean, what you get is the terror in the French Revolution, which is a period of terrible bloodletting and mass murder, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get, the worst case of it in modern times, of course, was in Cambodia, where they, mm-hmm. they wanted to reset the clock,
mm-hmm.
and that involved the deaths of millions of people. So we can only build on the past. We don't have to be bound by the past. And we can reject and develop and move beyond the bad parts, but also hold on to the good parts. And I think one of the things that's probably happening in Ireland, because it's happening everywhere, is a pressure against something that I think is a valuable part of all the traditions I mentioned, which is a place for family life and for the domestic, not as a place of oppression for women,
mm-hmm.
not as a place for patriarchal control of children, but as a place, a sort of starting out place, the place you start out from, and mm-hmm. spending time together with the people in your family, which can be, can be as narrow as two parents and a child, and as broad as the way I grew up. I grew up in a house opposite my grandparents, and so
mm-hmm.
I grew up with many children and many adults, but still we were a family. And for a child, I think that's the best context.
Yes.
But it has to be. You have to be doing things together. You have to be mm-hmm. eating together and maybe playing games together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of that's getting lost in some of our societies. Mm-hmm. It's less common than it used to be. And it's a wonderful thing. And so I think that kind of sociability, starting with family life, is really important.
It's a good place to go. I'm very conscious of your time, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I have one last question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So again, just another one of your lectures in the Wreath series was about colour and about race. And you gave the example of Anton Willem Amo, who was a Ghanaian child who was brought to Europe and adopted by an aristocratic family and given a life of privilege and absolutely excelled. It was a social experiment, I guess, in mm-hmm. one sense.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the experiment trying to prove? That there's no difference in race, really, that people who are given the same
yeah.
advantages in life, regardless of race, should basically can achieve the same
yes,
things.
Yes. Well, it certainly did establish that you could take someone from Africa, give him the best education in Germany, and he ended up as a professor of philosophy in
yes.
Germany. And then, amazingly, even
came
more amazingly, he went back home and retired. So, yes, and I think what that shows, this happened in the first half of the 18th century, and what that shows is that the ways of thinking about race that gradually solidified in the 19th century, at which point people would have thought it was obvious that that wouldn't work
mm-hmm.
because they had this idea that races were kind of cut off from one another and radically different.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, in the early 18th century, that idea just wasn't in place. And so the Dukes of Wolfenbüttel, who adopted him, he was their godson, were entertaining the possibility that this would work out fine, and it did work out fine.
It did, but the only thing is that was basically his circumstances were he had all of this advantage around him. That was the thing that separated him from the other young men who were on that ship with him. That like did he have cousins and brothers?
Well, one of his brothers ended up as a slave.
Yes,
in Suriname, in the Dutch,
in Suriname,
Dutch
that's
West
right.
Indies.
So, the difference, obviously, between him and his brother, then, and their two extremely different lives, and their two, like, who fulfilled what within their lives, the quality of their life that we talked about at the start of this podcast, was down to the circumstances that
yes.
he found himself in.
Yes.
And That is it. Obviously, he was a man of great intellect and natural ability and, you know, was able for absolutely everything, so much capability, as are so many young people. You know, they have so many capabilities. And the thing that really holds them back is their circumstances, you know, their lack of. And that's it. You know, like we can have you have your things that create our identity, you know, that we can't change, you know, like your race or your gender or your sex or, you know, like, so you have this kind of list of things, this hit list of things that kind of are our identity, our religion, our ethnicity, our nationalism, who we are and what we're about. But really then there is another part that creates our identity, and that is the circumstances that we find ourselves in.
It's always a dialogue identity. Mm-hmm. You're never in charge of your own
and
identity.
And that can work out for the best or for the worst. I don't know if you ever saw a film called Monster. Charlize Theron played a very famous serial killer who was in Florida. Her name was Aileen Wuornos, I think. And I think the title of the movie kind of encapsulated what her life was about. So basically, she was a monster. She was a serial killer. She killed a lot of people. She died on death row. But following, once we get to understand and kind of empathise with what her life story was, she had a really terrible kind of experience growing up. She was abused as a child. She was isolated. She was alienated from her community. Mm. These children really abused her and took advantage of her. And, you know, she was just always really in this really awful circumstance. And actually, one of the things in the movie was she talked about that. She talked about how it was all about circumstances. That's what your life is. Yes. Your life is the circumstances that you end up in. So how much of that, I mean, how much of that contributes to, and is there a way if you have a strong sense of yourself, and if you have a stronger, is there evidence to suggest that people who have a stronger sense of who they are and a stronger personal identity are able to transcend the circumstances that which they are in?
I think we're always creatures of our circumstances, but people differ. So another fine example here in American literature is the great anti-slave activist Frederick Douglass in the 19th century. Now, he was born a slave and escaped from slavery. And he wrote some autobiographies, he ran a newspaper, and he was very active in the abolition movement. And after slavery was abolished, he ended up serving the United States I think he was the ambassador to Haiti or somewhere. But anyway, it's clear that this man, you know, was in circumstances where other people didn't rise up, resist, discover their rights, and in his case, literally, just escape from slavery, and he left slavery. So other people in those very circumstances didn't do that. So there's something individual about how people respond to their circumstances. Yes, yes. We're always a mixture of both. But the moral truth, of course, is that nobody should be raised in the circumstances that the monster woman was raised in, and nobody should be raised in the circumstances that Frederick Douglass was raised in. And all of us are entitled to be raised in decent circumstances with a surrounding of family love and a community in which our dignity is respected and so on. Mm-hmm. And too many people in the world today don't have that. Mm-hmm. It is still the case for large parts of the population of India, because of their caste system, which has not gone away, that people have to struggle to maintain their dignity. Or people who've done nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. They've just been born.
Yes.
You know, for women in Saudi Arabia, the only form of dignity available is as a wife and mother, as an obedient wife, and as a mother. And again, that limits their circumstances in a way that I think is morally indefensible. So we need to ensure that everybody on the planet has circumstances that are sustaining, and then it's up to them to make of those circumstances a life that is a meaningful life, a life of achievements, defined, though, the achievements defined by them, by who they are. It's not a competition. You're not trying to live a better life than your neighbor, or let a better life than Gandhi, or a better life than, you know,
Oprah.
That's the wrong way to think about it. Oprah's living.
And I do think that we live in a world, especially for young people, you know, they're exposed to social media constantly, Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, everything, you know, like people's best lives. Justin Bieber, Kim Kardashian, you know, we're looking at people living extreme forms of luxury.
Yes.
And I guess that can be daunting and intimidating.
But I think it also sets the wrong problem. It sets the wrong project. The right project is to live a life that makes sense to me in the circumstances that I have and the circumstances that I achieve.
And that's a lot simpler of a task, I think, than trying to
break
Hollywood.
It's a possible task. We can't all be Kim Kardashian.
And possibly a far more fulfilling task as well,
yes.
Really.
No. I mean, I think it's sort of, as it were, that life has already been lived.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can watch it. You can watch the Bieber life if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But that's done. Somebody's done that. Justin Bieber's already done the Justin Bieber life,
mm-hmm.
So, and he's doing it. You have to do your Kwame Anthony Appiah life. other people, you can learn from other people,
mm-hmm.
And you can admire other people. You can try not to envy other people, and so on. So I don't mean you should ignore what other people are doing, but in the end, it's your life. And you have to live your life, not somebody else's life, not some life imagined because you spend too much time watching reality television.
Listen, I think that's an absolutely fantastic little piece of advice for our listeners to end on there. So I just want to say one final time, thank you so much, Professor Appiah. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the UCD podcast today. So thank you once again for your time.
Well, thank you for coming.
Appreciate it.
Enjoy New York.
I will.